You're tuned to 89.1 WGLT.org. I'm Laura Kennedy with this WGLT Datebook. Noir, be it film or novel, is more than we've come to accept through the years. That's the view in a new collection of essays edited by two Illinois State University professors. Noir Effect takes a new approach to the classic genre of noir. Co-edited by Christopher Brew and Elizabeth Hatmaker, the book reveals that noir is more than simply a specific cycle of mid-century American movies or books. Brew explains that the book explores the noir genre through what's known as affect theory.
Affect actually is about the way in which the body is affected by social dynamics and psychological dynamics before we're even physically fully conscious of it. If you've ever entered into a room and felt the mood of that room, that's affect. It's the quality of feeling between people that actually shapes how we respond to each other.
What inspired you to do this book? Was there like an instant something happened and something went click, or did it sort of, the idea kind of creep up on you?
My first book was called Hard-Boiled Masculinities, and it was on the figure of the hard-boiled male in 20s, 30s, and 40s, both pulp fiction and also modernist fiction from the period. And so I already had
noir showed up in that.
Yeah, exactly. Noir showed up in that. I was married to Elizabeth Hatmaker, the other person who is the editor of this book, and she unfortunately passed away from ALS in 2017. We were both huge noir fans, and we also worked off of each other all the time. She was a poet, a brilliant poet, as well as a thinker. And, you know, and I was a literary critic and somebody who's into theory and stuff like that. And so we actually wound up watching a lot of films together, and she had a reading of noir that I think we developed together. I need to give credit to her, because she really said there's a quality in noir that isn't about any of the things that people generally talk about when they talk about noir, you know, whether it's femme fatales and tough guys, or whether it's chiaroscuro lighting or any of those, you know, the canted frame or any of that stuff. She says it's a quality of discomfort. It's a quality of actually being too close to things that are actually disturbing or upsetting or painful or that you don't want to look at. And that became the basis for talking about noir affect, that noir is as a form or as a mode, it's very much about foregrounding things that actually, that we don't want to look at and that disturb us, and that the uncomfortable dimensions of everyday life. Everybody keeps trying to find a way of talking about it as a genre, or talking about it as a fixed set of approaches, you know, or even as a set of films or a set of books that had a specific historical trajectory. And a lot of people talked about it as an American form, but we kept seeing things that actually were noir, or that we felt were noir, that didn't fit any of those models. A lot of the most interesting noir isn't necessarily in the genre of detective fiction, or even necessarily crime fiction. It can also show up in science fiction. You know, you think about something like Blade Runner is playing. It can show up in video games. It can show up in music. Think about something like Frank Sinatra's, you know, Dark albums, you know, the melancholy albums. I mean, those almost explicitly play with noir tropes. You know, we watched a lot of film. It can also show up in like Italian gialli, which is a form of Italian films that was borrowed from Italian pulp novels. You know, and then there's the whole French love of it as well. And so we felt like the idea that this could be like pinned down to a specific set of both a specific genre and also a specific historical period, we felt like it didn't do justice to all the work being done in noir, both in the present and the past, that it was much more diverse, and that it was actually much harder to pin down, that there was a quality of elusiveness to it that we were interested in. And we thought that affect could actually get at that elusiveness.
I was interested in the Japanese angle.
The Katsu studio in Japan actually did a number of noirs. So noir was actually a part of Japanese culture right from the, you know, almost from the beginning of the American version. This is actually a much more transnational history than a lot of, you know, accounts of it, especially a lot of popular accounts, like to recognize.
Christopher, how did you go about selecting your contributors for this?
We actually decided to contact everybody that we thought of who might make sense, who understood what affect theory was and understood, you know, noir. You know, part of when you actually work on you know, things like detective fiction and noir and popular culture, you get to know people who also do some of the same kinds of work. And so we didn't do a general call, which is what a lot of collections do. We instead contacted people we thought would really be good. And we tried to also contact a range of people, both from some of them were grad students, some of them were you know, really well-respected professors. You know, the Paulo Rabinowitz, who writes the afterword, is one of the great thinkers and writers about noir of the last 20 to 30 years. We tried to sort of reach out to a range of people, but we especially wanted to actually we wanted to contact people who weren't just going to give us the same old story that we always get of noir that you can find anytime you turn on TCM and they're introducing a noir movie, and, you know, which I love. I mean, I'm not trying to like trash that at all. I mean, I'm so glad that that kind of stuff is out there, but we wanted to tell a different story. And so we wanted to make sure we also contacted people who were, we wanted to represent the sort of international dimensions of noir. So we had Peter Hitchcock writing on manga. We had Ignacio Sanchez Prado writing on Mexican noir. You know, we have an essay on Italian noir. We have essays on French film, also an essay on queer noir. Sean Gratton talks about queer noir and the Anne Bannon books. And then, you know, myself and Kieran Watcher Green both talk about African-American noirs and sexuality in African-American noirs. And so we wanted to give a very different story than the same old players, you know, the Hammett, Chandler, Kane, Woolrich. And, you know, there were a lot of women writers of noir who weren't always recognized too. Patricia Highsmith, who I absolutely love. We wanted to represent the kind of panoply of noir and the kinds of different ways in which the kind of negative affect that we saw as central to noir could be taken and used in different texts. And so we wanted to just sort of give people a sense of like that this is an international field that's, you know, that's burgeoning. It's not just a nostalgia market. It's not just a market of something that has been. Instead, there are people, you know, all the Scandinavian noir that's appearing right now too.
It's highly, highly popular.
Yeah,
it's really influential, first in Britain and now it's over here. We're just sort of picking up on that mood. Why do you suppose right now it's really starting to just expand and sink even further into our psyches? Why are we seeking this out to create as artists are creating? And why are audiences, you know, wanting more and more and more?
I think there's a few reasons. I think one of them is that we're living in an economic era, not just in the US, but globally, in which basically the rhetoric is that self-improvement and self-help and maximizing your self-potential is actually what we're supposed to be doing. And that anytime we fail at achieving our goals, it's our fault. It's nobody else's fault is a lot of the rhetoric of contemporary economics and contemporary culture. And that, you know, you just need to have a positive attitude. And I think that ideology really becomes limiting and people feel really, really frustrated. And when people fall through the cracks, noir is what speaks to them. Noir actually foregrounds the people on the losing end of the economic situation. It foregrounds the two-time losers. It foregrounds the loners. It foregrounds the people who have a perverse relationship to sexuality. And I mean that, I don't mean that term judgmentally. I mean it affirmatively, but a perverse relationship to everyday culture. It actually shows what a lot of contemporary culture wants to cover over. And instead, like, actually has you sympathize with the loser, with the criminal, with the excluded. So that's why I think it actually has an appeal right now, because a lot of people are living very precarious lives, you know, especially since 2008 and the right now in COVID too, we're living in very precarious lives. I also think there's just a lot of great work out there. People like Megan Abbott and Gillian Flynn, who write, you know, amazing noirs and now are having their stuff translated into film. My favorite essays in the book is by my friend Pam Thoma, and she actually writes about what she calls chick noir. And chick noir is like the follow-up to chick flicks and chick lit. And she says after 2008, it was no longer a kind of retooling of romance, you know, for post-feminist readers, but instead it was a retooling of noir. And it was about the way in which femininity was always under surveillance, even when it was downwardly mobile.
Well, of course, what you have is a book that Fordham published. Mm-hmm. And so you have a hard copy. People can download digital copies too, I'm sure. Since you are talking about movies, are you looking at perhaps including something with your book, some sort of digital aspect where people can read the book and also perhaps see elements from the films that are being referenced? So are you thinking of maybe creating something like that to go with your book, a digital aspect?
I love the idea. We haven't done that yet. I whenever I read a book like this, I wind up tracking down like all the titles because I just, you know, I get excited, right? I have actually done a couple of visual lectures and recorded like me reading the introduction just to sort of frame it for people, you know, especially in this COVID time. I was actually supposed to do a bunch of presentations of this material and on the West Coast in May, and it all collapsed because of COVID.
There's your noir effect there.
Right, exactly.
So, yeah. Christopher, tell me about that though. Expand on that a little bit about how you edit it. You bring all these elements together. You write a portion of it. You put your heart and soul into it. And then a virus comes along and scuppers all of your plans. So how do you, when you're faced with something like that, how do you, as an artist and an academic, as a person, how do you deal with something like that? That must have been very disappointing.
It was, although, you know, I felt really lucky in certain ways. And I don't mean that, you know, I'm not trying to be, you know, just sort of happy-go-lucky here. That's just what I was critiquing, right, on a certain level. But, you know, although that tends to be my own disposition is noir in certain ways, but not on the surface. It was disappointing, but I was just happy that it came out. Because I know people whose books were delayed. I know people who, like, you know, where they were really uncertain whether the press was going to come through. And so I was just happy that it was far enough along that when COVID hit, there was no way in which it wasn't going to come out. I do think that one of the things that noir teaches us is to be ready for contingency, to be ready for chance, to be ready for the bad roll of the dice as well as the good roll of the dice, you know. And this book was written, conceived of with somebody I love very much and who was absolutely vital and alive when we first started conceiving it. And then who I was a caretaker, you know, for caregiver for, and then I watched, you know, die rather quickly from a horrible disease. There's nothing more noir than that, you know, and being able to like sort of carry through, and more for her than me, obviously, but being able to carry through the book and make sure that it came into print, that mattered more to me than anything else. It was a tribute to her and to the intellectual work we did together, you know? And so in a certain way, COVID was less of an upheaval than Elizabeth getting sick. It was more of an upheaval, obviously, for everybody else. You know, I don't mean to, like, I'm not trying to
minimize. You'd already been through it. You'd already been through the ringer. And so when this came on, you were like,
yeah,
you know, I've been through enough already that toughens you up. I mean, it's a hard thing to go through. Anything like that will toughen anybody up.
Absolutely.
I mean, we all sort of metaphorically have those cigarettes hanging out of our mouths and the death of stale whiskey on our breath because we live life and we have to deal with that.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things that noir teaches you is that you can look as long as you can and as long as you're able to at the scary truths in life and learn to exist with them, if not finally be happy about them, you know? And I think that there's an ethics there that I think the book is about, that we need to look at the negative stuff and we need to look at our own failings, at the failings of our systems, at the failings of everyday people and not see them. And the contingency of life, that life, you know, that death is not something that we can plan and is not something we have control over, but that death is contingent. You know, there's a great Dashiell Hammett line in The Maltese Falcon, or it's allegory that he basically, a parable, I think is what people often call it, in the middle of the book. And it's called the Flitcraft Parable. And it doesn't show up in the film. It's actually a book about a guy who is living a normal life. And then our beam falls right in front of him. And he realizes he almost could have died walking home from work. Spade is hired by his wife to find out what happened to him because he just never came home. And he left two kids and a wife, you know, in somewhere generic, like Midlands, Texas, I think. Spade tracks him down and finds him 2 years later. He's living with a woman who looks exactly like his first wife. He has two kids and he's working in a similar job. And he's living in like another sort of nowhere town, like somewhere in Oregon, but not a major city, you know? And so Spade says, what happened? And he goes, well, this beam fell in front of me. And so after that, I saw life with the lid off and I saw the works inside and I realized I didn't like what I saw. And so for 2 years, I lived as if beams were going to fall every second of the day. And I partied and I slept around and I, you know, traveled the country. And then at some point beams stopped falling. And I went back to the way in which I just was living my life. But that idea of beams falling is, I think, precisely what noir is about. That, you know, you just have to deal with the beam falling. COVID is a beam falling. You deal with it and you find a way of living with that. And then when they stop falling, you go back to doing what you do.
That's Illinois State University English professor Christopher Brew, co-editor of Noir Effect, available from Fordham University Press. I'm Laura Kennedy.